the dour, yet capable, Dolores. Cam always thinks of old photos of Amelia Earhart when she sees Dolores. She's older than Earhart was when she disappeared, probably in her 50s or maybe her 60s. It's hard to tell. But she's got the same lean, mannish build, an outdoorsy, weathered-looking face, and a shock of unkempt short hair. Only hers is salt and pepper. Cam mentioned the resemblance to Tess, who passed it on to Beth, who reportedly said, "Too bad Dolores hasn't fallen off the face of the earth, too." There's no love lost between Debbie's kids and their summer caregiver. "She's creepy," according to Jonathan. "A royal pain in the butt," according to Beth. "Suck it up and deal," is their mother's usual response. "As long as my kids are alive whenever I come back, she's doing her job," so said Debbie to Cam, Gwen, and Petra just last week. Cam is sure she was joking in her cavalier Debbie way. Well, pretty sure. She herself wouldn't joke about kids being alive or not. The first couple of times Dolores came to the beach with the kids, Cam or one of the others invited her to join them. They had gravitated toward this same spot every sunny day with an unspoken arrangement to meet here around 11 and hang out till 3 or 4. Dolores always said no, then set herself up beneath an umbrella situated just close enough to make things good and awkward. She's there now, a few yards away, down toward the lifeguard stand. Cam has to admit, she keeps a better eye on Debbie's kids than Debbie does. In fact, she seems to keep a joyless surveillance over the whole scene, never bringing a book or magazine, or leaning back to nap in the shade. With old eagle-eyed Dolores on the beach, Cam should probably rest assured that nothing's going to happen to Tess if she herself looks away for a moment. The horrific, recurring vision about Tess has never been as vivid as it was that first day at the Pearsons' house. Maybe that's because Cam was so in tune with what had just happened to Rebecca, and the house was teeming with people, charged with emotional energy. Armed with the growing, yet inexplicable conviction that Rebecca is no longer alive, Cam still wakes up every morning wondering if this will be the day they'll find her somewhere, her remains. Yet deep down, she's starting to sense that it's not going to happen. Ever. She gets the feeling that every physical trace of Rebecca has been obliterated. How? She doesn't know. She can't bring herself to consider the scenarios. Every time she has a terrifying flash of Tess afraid, Tess in danger, she has to fight the urge to do something about it. Something other than stay on top of her 24/7. Insist that she travel in supervised groups, install new deadbolts in the beach house. She had to tell Mike she wanted to change the locks. It's half his house, and anyway, he pays all the bills. When she brought it up, she braced herself for him to accuse her of being drunk and paranoid again. Surprisingly, he didn't say a word. He just told her to get the locksmith there and have the bill sent to him. She did send it, along with a set of new keys. It was the right thing to do. Having the new bolts on all the doors and windows helps her sleep a little better at night. Although, when you think about it, someone could easily cut a screen and come in that way. And it's too hot to sleep with the windows closed. Nagged by uneasiness, Cam rises from her chair to check on Tess again. This time, both Tess and Heath happen to see her. Tess shakes her head and looks away, and her body language says it all. "I'm so sorry, sweetie," Cam thinks, hating what she's doing to Tess and to herself. But she can't help it. She knows what she saw. She knows what's going to happen to Tess if she's not careful. Still, there's a part of her that wonders, are you going to watch over her every second for the rest of her childhood? The rest of her life? "Dude, your mother is intense." Tess rolls her eyes. "No kidding." She likes it when Heath calls her dude. It's kind of his pet name for her, which makes it romantic. That's what she told Beth, who didn't see it that way. According to Beth, there's nothing romantic about being called dude. "How come your mother's always checking up on you when you're with me?" Heath asks. "Doesn't she trust me?"
"She doesn't trust anyone. It's not about you. She checks up on me all the time, no matter who I'm with."
"Why?"
"Who knows? It's freaky. She was never like this before. I think maybe it's the pregnancy hormones or something.
Heath shrugs, looking uninterested. Tess isn't particularly interested in pregnancy hormones herself. She only knows that Mom blames them for a lot of things. Being moody, eating half a mushroom pizza in one sitting, losing her keys. That was the worst. The day with the keys a few weeks ago. Mom had them in her beach bag as usual, but when she and Tess got back to the house and she went to unlock the door, they weren't there. They had to backtrack all the way back down to the beach and look through the sand. Mom was sure they had fallen out of the bag. She even checked with the lifeguards and the lost and found. Nothing. When they got back home, there were Mom's keys, sitting on the walk by the front steps.
I must have dropped them somehow, Mom said, looking puzzled. I wonder why we didn't hear them hit the ground.
I'm hot, Heath cuts into her thoughts. Want to go in the water?
Sure.
Tess allows him to take her hand and pull her to her feet. Naturally, her mother makes a beeline for them as they head toward the water, still holding hands.
Tess?
Tess ignores her. I think your mother's calling you.
I think you're right,
Tess flashes Heath a tight grin.
Tess!
With a sigh, she looks back.
Be careful, Mom calls. Not too deep.
Whatever, Tess mutters, embarrassed. To Heath, she says, you don't know how lucky you are that your parents aren't around this summer.
Oh, yeah, I do.
The Pickerings, both of whom have high-powered corporate jobs in the city, are back home in Montclair. Heath is staying here on the island at their beach house with his older brother, Brooks. Heath's parents occasionally come down on weekends. She knows which house is theirs, on North Atlantic Avenue, pretty fancy with a hot tub and an in-ground pool. She's never been there or met his parents, or Brooks, who graduated college last year and works nights as a bartender. He pays little attention to Heath's comings and goings. Must be nice.
Brr,
Tess says, as the cold seawater washes around her ankles.
Come on, it's not that bad.
He throws himself into the surf.
It's cold.
Yeah, you think so? Floating on his back, Heath eyes her, and she admires his smile and his tan and his sun-lightened hair, marveling yet again that he's actually her boyfriend. It happened so fast. He kissed her for the first time on the 4th of July, beneath a canopy of fireworks. It was straight out of her imaginary fantasy life, so surreal that even then, when it was happening, Tess was still thinking it might be a joke. But here they are, a month later, and going strong. Yeah, and they'd probably be going stronger if it wasn't for Mom breathing down Tess's neck every second of every day. And night. Back at the very beginning, Heath wanted to talk about what had happened in Montclair. But he didn't specifically mention the notebook and Mrs. Heath Pickering. He just said someone, Chad, told him that Tess Hastings liked him and pointed her out to him.
I thought you were cute, he said. So I got your number and texted you.
And she told him to leave her the hell alone. Yeah. Nice work, Tess. Way to waste an entire month you could have had with Heath.
I thought you were someone else, she told him.
Someone else named Heath Pickering? He asked dubiously, and she just shrugged. He let it go at that. Heath isn't the type to dwell on things, and Tess is trying not to either. The water laps above her knees, and she shivers again.
Coming in?
Heath paddles closer, stands.
I have to get used to it first.
Heath reaches out and picks her up in one quick motion.
What are you doing?
Tess screams.
Getting you used to it. It's freezing! You're freezing!
Tess shrieks and wriggles against his bare, wet chest, laughing as he carries her deeper. The next thing she knows, they're both in the water up to their necks.
That was a dirty trick!
Teeth chattering, she flicks water at him.
I was doing you a favor. You can't wade in little by little. Only way to do it is plunge in head first.
Maybe that's your style, but it's not mine.
Hey,
Heath reaches out and touches her cheek. You're bleeding.
I am?
She touches the spot.
Just a tiny bit. It looks like you got scratched or something while we were fooling around. God, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Does it hurt?
Not at all.
He leans closer and kisses it. Sorry, he says again. And suddenly the water isn't feeling nearly as cold.
It's totally fine. But maybe now you learned your lesson about grabbing people and throwing them into the water.
I have. Definitely. Heath is looking at something behind her.
What's wrong?
Is that?
What?
Tess looks over her shoulder.
Nothing. I just thought I saw... Never mind.
What?
She asks, his expression making her uneasy. A fin, but it might have just been a shadow. In a flash, she remembers the legend of the great white shark off Beachhaven, and she's bleeding. Screaming, she splashes her way frantically toward shore, half swimming, half running. Any second, she's sure, something is going to bump up against her legs underwater, maybe savagely tear off a limb, or eat her alive in one ferocious bite.
Tess! Tess!
Heath is calling her. People are turning to look.
Tess, stop, there's nothing out here.
She turns back to see Heath laughing.
I was just kidding, he calls, swimming toward her.
Dude, it was a joke.
A joke? About a shark?
That was the least funny joke I ever heard.
Tess isn't sure whether to be embarrassed or annoyed.
I'm sorry.
Heath reaches her, embraces her.
Do you forgive me?
How can she not? He's Heath, the guy of her dreams. Tess would forgive him for just about anything. Taking a pack of cigarettes from the top of her packed beach bag, Petra looks at Cam.
Do you mind if I...
Yeah, Cam minds, but it's Gwen who speaks up. Oh, Lord, if you're going to smoke, go do it somewhere else.
That's what I love about you, Gwen. You're so damn frank.
Petra says in a tone that makes it clear she doesn't love that at all.
I just don't want to die young from secondhand smoke.
Yeah, I get it.
Petra takes her cigarettes and ambles down the beach, lighting one as she goes.
Is it just me, or is she really touchy lately? Gwen asks.
Everyone's touchy lately. It's the heat.
No one's as touchy as Petra, Gwen grumbles as Cam stands and checks again for Tess.
Still fine. Still swimming around out there with Heath. Still madly in love.
She's just stressed about her kids or whatever.
Who isn't?
Cam sits again with a groan. All this up and down is killing her.
You know, Tess is fine, Gwen says. You're making yourself crazy. Why are you so worried about her all the time?
She's my baby girl.
Not for long.
Startled, Cam looks up.
Oh,
Gwen is pointing at Cam's stomach, protruding in a black maternity bathing suit.
Pretty soon that'll be your baby girl, she explains, seemingly oblivious to Cam's initially ominous interpretation.
Or boy.
The ultrasound tech thought it was a girl, though, right?
Gwen asks, and Cam nods. She had the routine sonogram last week, back in Montclair. Tess came with her, grudgingly at first, because she didn't want to miss a day with Heath. But when the white blob appeared on the screen and the technician started pointing out her unborn sibling's tiny beating heart and jerking limbs, Tess was fascinated.
Do you want to know the sex?
The technician asked, and Tess answered for both of them.
Yes!
The technician looked at Cam, who hesitated.
What about Dad?
She asked Tess. Mike was in Japan on business. If he hadn't been, she'd have asked him to be there.
If Dad doesn't want to know what it is, we won't tell him,
Tess said. Dilemma averted. The technician thought it might be a girl. Tess was elated by the thought of a little sister.
You do know that the only way to be positive about the sex is an amnio, right?
Gwen asks Cam now.
I know.
If a boy pops out, I'll be surprised, but whatever. It's fine.
Mike, she suspects, would love to have a son. Mike the third.
So you're not having one?
An amnio?
When Cam shakes her head, Gwen does too.
You should, at your age. Dr. Advani said the same thing. Cam tells Gwen what she told the obstetrician. Too many risks involved with the test, and I don't need to know if there's something wrong with the baby before it's born. I wouldn't do anything about it anyway.
No?
No, absolutely not. Would you?
Gwen shrugs. Moot point. I'm done having babies.
You never know. What if you meet someone and...
No, I mean I can't.
Gwen looks away down the beach, where Petra is walking along the waterline and puffing away.
I'm sorry, Cam says uncomfortably.
No biggie, Gwen returns.
But it is. Cam can tell. Great. Why does she seem to keep sticking her foot in her mouth everywhere she goes lately?
Don't beat yourself up. You've been distracted.
Things were stressful enough with the pregnancy, sobriety, Rebecca, and those visions involving Tess, and other visions as well. Here and there, glimpses of children in trouble. Whenever they strike, she writes down what she sees in a fresh notebook she keeps hidden under her mattress. Add Mike to the mix, and no wonder she's a basket case. He's coming down tomorrow to spend the weekend. His idea. He'd called, not long after the curtailed D.C. trip with Tess and the unresolved telephone argument, to say they needed to talk, in person.
I think that would be good, Cam said cautiously, sensing he had reached some kind of resolution. When do you want to come?
I can't get away till the beginning of August, since I took that extra time over the 4th, and I'm in Tokyo until almost the end of July.
So come in August.
How about the first weekend? He asked, as if she might have other plans.
We'll be here, she hesitated.
You're staying with us, right? In the house?
He hesitated too. Is that okay?
It would be uncomfortable if he didn't. Probably even more uncomfortable if he does, but...
Yeah, she told him. Of course.
She's been wondering ever since where he's expecting to sleep. That, she supposes, will depend on where he wants to go from here. The couch is a pullout, and not all that comfortable. Her father occupied it for a few nights earlier this summer, until just after the 4th of July. One morning he woke up, hugged her and Tess goodbye, and said he'd see them again soon. Then he ambled off in his Ike way, and they haven't heard from him since. What if he shows up again this weekend? Then Mike won't be able to use the couch, meaning he'll just have to sleep in the bedroom with Cam, regardless of where he wants to go from here. Or, she supposes, Tess could sleep with her and Mike could have the twin bed in her room. But that would be awkward. Almost as awkward as sharing a bed, once again, with her husband. So far, it basically sounds like there isn't an aspect of the looming weekend that won't be awkward. It doesn't help that Mike, without consulting her, sent Tess a gift from Japan. A cell phone. Not just a cell phone, as Tess, thrilled, explained to Cam, but some kind of tiny, fancy internet phone, cutting-edge technology. Mike's fort, not hers.
Isn't it the coolest thing ever?
Tess kept asking, eager to show it off to her friends.
Now Dad and I can stay in touch even better.
As far as Cam is concerned, the coolest thing ever would be if Tess could stay in touch with her dad simply by living under the same roof. That, however, isn't likely to happen. Not if he's upgrading their daughter's cell phone, probably making plans to move to a bigger apartment, too, where Tess can have her own room. Seeing Petra coming toward them again now, Cam wonders if Mike might even go for shared custody, like Petra's husband did. Let him try. She'd fight it. If Mike wants a divorce, he can have a divorce. But he can't take away her child. Mike! Standing in the doorway, his mother goes pale beneath her ruddy summer complexion.
What are you doing here?
Is Dad home?
Yes. Is something wrong? Did something happen?
I just want to talk to you, both of you. He crosses the threshold into the familiar home where he was raised. It smells of bleach and bacon. Mom has been cooking and cleaning today. Same as every day.
It's a modest home, but now worth millions. His father is proud of that. Proud to be able to say that he made all the right moves in his life at all the right times.
How's Tess? His mother asks.
She's good. I haven't seen her in a few weeks, though. I've been away. I'm going down to see her tomorrow.
Give her my love.
His mother pauses, tucking her hands into the pockets of her lemon-yellow summer slacks.
And Cam, too.
Yeah, I will.
Cam. The thought of her fills him with guilt. Again, he thinks of that day in the car, of her far-fetched claim to be a modern-day Nostradamus, of the moment of truth that struck him. Well, more like hit him over the head like an anvil, right after he hung up the phone. He knew, then and there, what he was going to do. But he was helpless, stuck in traffic, and the moment passed. When the road opened again, it was late. He drove back to New York, went back to his life, back to work, to Japan. But the truth dogged him every step of the way. He follows his mother to the kitchen, past a gallery of framed photos from the annual ski trip. Cam and Tess are conspicuously missing from the most recent. Mike quickly looks away, again plagued by guilt.
Dad's out on the deck. I just got back from the hairdresser.
Some things never change. His mother has had a standing Friday afternoon appointment for as long as Mike can remember.
You look beautiful, as usual, Mom.
She smiles and pats her hair.
Do you want something cold to drink?
Just ice water. I can get it.
I'll get it.
She opens the cupboard for a glass, fills it with ice, then hands it to him with a bottle of Poland Spring.
Are you hungry? Did you eat lunch?
I'm fine, Mom.
He opens the slider to the deck. His father, wearing a pink polo shirt and sitting in a carefully weathered teak chair facing the sound, looks up from a golf magazine.
Mike, what's up, son?
His mother says.
He wants to talk to us.
About what?
Mike sets the magazine aside.
How about some ice water, Marge? It's hotter than hell out here.
Just once, Mike thinks, as he watches his mother head back into the house. He would love to see her tell his father to get up and get something for himself.
How was Japan, Mike?
It was fine.
Did you catch up on some new technology?
He thinks of the tiny cell phone he sent his daughter, the one he promised would keep them linked, no matter how far apart they are.
Yeah, he tells his father. I did.
Are you still seeing that woman, Kate?
Mike wishes he had never mentioned that in the first place, but he did, back when he started seeing her, knowing Mike Sr. would approve. Before he can answer the question, his mother reappears with another ice-filled glass and water bottle.
Good.
Sit down, Mom.
You're scaring me, Mike. What is it?
Cam is pregnant.
What?
His mother squeals, then clasps a hand over her mouth and looks at his father.
Was this something you planned?
Is his first question. Of course.
What difference does it make? Mike asks.
Life doesn't always work out the way you planned. Just because she got herself pregnant doesn't mean...
She didn't get herself pregnant, Dad.
I did. Are you sure about that?
He hates the question. Hates that he'd asked it himself in so many words, directly of Cam.
Yeah, he tells his father.
I'm positive.
His father nods thoughtfully.
What are you going to do about it?
So what do you think? Heath asks Tess as they tread water, facing each other.
About what?
She returns, though she knows very well what he means.
Want to ditch your mom and do something fun for a change?
Like what?
I don't know. You can come to my house or something, he suggests.
When?
Whenever, he shrugs. We better go in. I've got to get ready to start working.
Together they start swimming toward shore.
How about tonight? Why don't you come to the party with me?
Heath asks. It's a bonfire. All the lifeguards are going. So is Beth.
I told you, my mother won't let me.
Tess already asked, twice.
Tomorrow night, then? Heath persists. Do you want to do something then?
What am I supposed to do about my mom? She'll never let me go out with you alone at night.
Don't tell her. Just say you're going over to Beth's. She'll cover for you.
Yeah, but Dolores won't, and I don't know when Debbie's coming back.
I think Jared said tonight or tomorrow. You should check.
Tired of kicking, Tess swings a leg down to see if she can stand yet. Nope, still too deep.
Why don't you just tell your mother you and Beth are going to a movie or something? She can drop you off there and everything. I'll meet you and we'll go someplace until the movie would have been over. Pick a long one.
Tess isn't sure how she feels about that plan. Not that it matters. I doubt my mother would even let me do that, she tells Heath. She's been acting really weird. She'd think she had to wait up, and that would be impossible because lately she falls asleep at, like, 8 o'clock, which is the only break I get from her watching me breathe.
Seeing the look on Heath's face, and worried he's deciding a younger girl with an overprotective mother is too much trouble, she adds quickly,
My dad's coming tomorrow for the weekend. Maybe he can talk some sense into her.
Your dad's coming? I didn't know that.
I didn't either until last night.
I thought he's in Japan.
He was. He's back. And he's staying with us for 2 days.
What's up with that? Heath asks. Are they getting back together or something?
Maybe. Who knows?
She doesn't even dare to hope. Again, she swings her leg down to see if she can stand yet. All I know is that I want to be alone with you, Tess.
I want to be alone with you, too.
Tess's feet hit the bottom, but she can't help feeling like she's still in way over her head. Petra looks happier now that she's had her nicotine fix, Gwen comments.
Definitely.
I wish she could just quit.
I'm sure she does, too.
Cam knows just how hard it is to kick an unhealthy habit, or addiction, when it comes to Petra and smoking. Habit, addiction. There's a difference, Cam has come to realize. She no longer believes her own drinking was a bona fide addiction, or that she's an alcoholic, or needs a 12-step program. Yes, it helped her to realize she had been drinking too much, for too many years, and that she had to stop. But she only started in the first place to block out the visions. She's no longer struggling against them. No, it's the opposite now. She'd welcome a vision if it meant she'd potentially be able to help a child in danger. The more she's able to see, the better. There's no way in hell I'm ever going back to drinking, she told Kathy when they spoke on the phone last night. It's over. I'm not even tempted. You're pregnant, Kathy reminded her. Sometimes your body naturally has an aversion to things that aren't good for the baby. You can't let your guard down. You have to work the program one day at a time. Blah, blah, blah. Kathy's AA rhetoric still gets on Cam's nerves sometimes. Kathy doesn't understand why Cam started drinking in the first place, doesn't understand why, aside from the pregnancy, she was able to stop. But at least Kathy no longer calls Cam every day, asking if she's been to a meeting. And Cam doesn't feel the need to avoid her calls when she does check in a few times a week. It's kind of nice to talk to someone who cares, someone who will be there when she gets home to Montclair in a few weeks, especially since she's really started to get the idea that Mike will not. Last night, when they talked, she asked Kathy if she's coming down to the island again anytime soon. Maybe before the summer's over, Kathy said.
I'm sorry I missed you when you were here in July.
So am I. It would be nice to see you. Kathy said the trip was spur of the moment. She and some friends decided on a weekend getaway, and one of them suggested visiting another friend who was staying in a rental house on Long Beach Island. The next thing I knew, there I was, right in the neighborhood, Kathy told Cam, and I knew I had to look you up.
Too bad that was such a crazy weekend for me, Cam said.
Understatement of the year. She asked Kathy where her friend's house is, but being unfamiliar with island geography, Kathy wasn't sure. All I know is that it was near the beach, she said, which means it could have been just about anywhere.
Oh, well. If you come down again, let me know in advance, Cam said, and Kathy promised to do that.
Cam just hopes it won't be this weekend with Mike here. How was your walk?
Gwen asks Petra as she sits down in her chair again.
Great. Your daughter's boyfriend has a mean streak, though, Cam.
Cam frowns. What do you mean?
I saw him teasing Tess out there, pretending there was a shark in the water. She was petrified.
Boys will be boys, Gwen says lightly.
I don't know. I can't imagine Tyler ever doing that to someone he liked.
Gazing out at the water, where Tess and Heath are swimming toward shore and looking amiable, Cam doesn't know what to make of it. She can't help but remember what happened to Tess back in Montclair with her so-called friends, who also happen to be friends of Heath's. What if he's playing her now? It's possible, Cam supposes. She doesn't know him all that well, or particularly trust him. But then, who do you trust, where Tess is concerned? Yeah, you're paranoid. Anyway, consider the source. Right. She shouldn't go jumping to conclusions about the integrity of Heath Pickering's intentions based on Petra's opinion. Didn't she just say in so many words that she hopes Tess and Heath break up so that poor lovelorn Tyler can date her? Looking out at the swimmers bobbing in the water, Cam realizes she can no longer see Tess and Heath. Leaping to her feet, heart pounding, she scans the beach. No sign of them. What's wrong? Gwen asks and stands, along with Petra. Cam, what are you looking at?
Tess! Where's Tess?
She starts for the water, panic washing over her.
Cam! She's right there!
Hearing Petra's shout, she stops short. Tess is, indeed, right back where she should be, rubbing her eyes as though she's just popped up from underwater.
Oh, thank God.
Cam presses a hand against her racing heart. Her friends watch her with obvious concern as she walks back over to the chairs.
Sorry, she says sheepishly. I lost sight of her for a second.
She sees Gwen and Petra exchange a look. They're thinking she's ridiculously overprotective, or maybe just crazy. She doesn't blame them. They don't know what she sees, what she fears, what she knows. Again, she thinks of the missing marble notebook. She's now almost 100% certain she brought it down here to the shore with her. She could swear she remembers seeing it the night she came home from the police station, even remembers writing Leah Roby's name in it. But it was so late, and she was tired. Maybe she dreamed the whole thing. Maybe she left that notebook behind in Montclair. She should have looked for it when she stopped back to check on the house last week after the ultrasound. Either the notebook was there all along, or it was here, and she somehow lost it. Or someone took it. Sitting in her chair again, Cam shivers in the sun. Chapter 17. Sitting in front of her laptop, waiting for the web page to load, Cam can hear the water still running in the shower. Tess has been in there for at least 15 minutes. When she gets out, she'll take forever to dry her hair and get dressed, especially since she knows Cam is waiting for her to go to the supermarket.
Go without me, she said, when Cam told her the plan on the way back from the beach. I don't want to go shopping.
Of course, Cam told her she had no choice. She's trying to make the most of this waiting time, straightening up the house for Mike's arrival tomorrow, doing laundry. Everything is sorted and the dryer's humming along. She can't start the wash again until Tess gets out of the shower, so she decided to kill some time on the internet, specifically browsing through the missing children's sites she's been frequenting for weeks now that the visions are back. She begins scanning the case records, checking each face to see if she recognizes it from a recent premonition. So far, no sign of the little towhead missing his two front teeth she saw in a vision the other day, or the beautiful African-American teen who's been haunting her for 2 weeks now. Hearing the water turn off in the bathroom at last, she mutters, "It's about time." In the laundry room off the kitchen, she tosses in a load of whites, then goes to the closed bathroom door. Knocking, she calls, "How about putting a move on, Tess? I don't want to be at the store all night."
"Then go ahead, I'll stay here."
"You're coming. Hurry up."
"Don't rush me."
Tess, ornery, is bound to drag this out forever. With a sigh, Cam returns to the computer and resumes scrolling through the web pages. Minutes later, a familiar face catches her eye. The girl is about Tess's age. Shoulder-length dark hair, glasses, brown eyes. Pretty. Cam scans the details quickly. Her name is Kimberly Claire Osborne, age 13, about 4'8" tall, 75 pounds, last seen wearing denim shorts, a white t-shirt, and Nikes, disappeared from Santa Monica 5 years ago, a probable runaway. The accompanying photo was taken on the day she disappeared, in one of those photo booths you find in old-fashioned five-and-dime stores and arcades. None of it rings a bell. And thinking back over her recent visions, Cam can't put her finger on any that involved this girl. Not recently, anyway. Maybe it was years ago, although she's been poring over the old notebooks, and she doesn't remember seeing anything that might have been in reference to this teenaged runaway. And she can't help but feel as though she saw the girl more recently. Could she have spotted her in person somewhere? She'd practically be an adult now, 18. She wouldn't even look like that anymore. Glancing back at Kimberly's face, Cam tries to imagine what it might look like today. That's when she sees it. Around Kimberly Osborne's neck is a shark's tooth hanging on a silver chain. It's been a good 10 minutes since Cam's Volvo drove away down Dolphin Avenue. Now is the time. Now or never. And never isn't an option. The street is quiet. It's the dinner hour. The air smells of beef seared over charcoal. It brings back memories of happier days. Grilling for one just isn't much fun. It never should have had to be this way. But things are going to change. The key turns easily in the back door lock. Cam left the washer and dryer on. Does that mean she's coming right back? No time to waste. The floor plan is familiar, unlike at John Murphy's house that night last month. There, it was necessary to fumble around in the dark, finding the way to the master bedroom. He never knew what hit him. One shot to the head, and there was no longer a chance that if ever some fraction of Rebecca Pearson's DNA was to wash up somewhere someday, anyone would possibly connect it to an early morning chumming expedition. Sure, it was a slim chance John Murphy could ever have made the connection, but even a slim chance is unacceptable. John Murphy, like Eddie Casolino, is out of the picture, a necessary casualty in a war that should never have had to be waged in the first place. None of this is my fault. It's hers. And she'll pay for what she's made me do. Through Cam's living room, down the hall, second door on the left. It only takes a minute. There. Now the stage is set. There's no going back. All we still need to get is Pringles, Cam tells Tess, looking up from her shopping list to consult the sign above the next aisle. Where do you think the snacks are? Hmm? Cam looks at Tess, standing there with her hands on the handle of the grocery cart, a faraway expression on her face. Cam has been lost in thought herself, still fixated on Kimberly Osborne and the shark's tooth necklace. It's probably a coincidence. Lots of people, lots of kids, probably have necklaces like that, especially kids who spend time in beach towns, where there are a dime a dozen in gift shops. Kimberly lived in Santa Monica. But when you saw her picture, before you noticed the necklace, you already thought she looked familiar. She almost called Detective Barricat to tell him about it, but stopped herself. Officially, the necklace is insignificant to the Pearson case, other than the fact that Rebecca was wearing it the day before she disappeared. So it's better for Cam to wait to mention it to the detective until she figures out where she might have seen Kimberly Osborne before. If you ever have seen her before. Maybe she's mistaken about it. With her wearing the necklace? It can't be a mistake. There has to be a connection. We need a mop in aisle 4, please. Clean up in aisle 4. The announcement breaks Cam out of her reverie. We have to find the snack aisle, she tells Tess again. Then she frowns and leans in closer.
What's this?
What?
This?
Tess reaches up to touch her cheek.
Oh, nothing. I got scratched.
How?
Who knows? It's fine.
Cam nods, not liking the expression in Tess's eyes, but uncertain what it means. Just focus on something straightforward, like grocery shopping. She leads the way to the next aisle. Condiments, oils, and dressings. No Pringles here.
Maybe we should do some chicken on the grill, she decides, picking up a bottle of barbecue sauce.
Hmm? I said, maybe we can have barbecued chicken while Dad's here. As if they're all one happy little family again.
That would be good. Listen, Mom.
Yeah? She adds the barbecue sauce to the heap in the cart.
I want to go to the movies tomorrow night with Beth, okay?
Cam looks at her. Tess suddenly becomes very interested in the nutrition chart on a jar of mayo. She's lying, Cam realizes. She's not going to the movies with Beth. She's going with Heath. Or maybe she's not even going to the movies at all.
No, Cam says decisively. I want you with us this weekend.
So I can't see my friends at all?
You can see them. With us.
I thought you and Dad had to talk. I thought that was why he's coming.
What does that have to do with?
Don't you need to talk in private? What am I supposed to do?
Cam considers that. Tess has a point. If she's otherwise occupied, Cam and Mike can have some time to themselves, to talk about working things out, or to decide not to. But what if something happens to Tess the moment Cam lets her out of her sight?
You can't go off anywhere with your friends this weekend.
Tess opens her mouth to protest.
Sorry, Cam cuts her off. But case closed.
That's not fair. You never let me do anything.
Cam can't argue with that. Nor can she explain to Tess that it's for her own good. All she can do is continue to say no and keep Tess in a virtual prison for the rest of her life. Some way to live, she thinks grimly. But it's sure as hell better than the alternative. The photograph is an old one, chronologically organized in a leather-bound album filled with pictures of illustrious people, exotic places. But tonight, Kathy isn't interested in revisiting her social circle, her travels, even her beloved four-year-old Bichon Frise, Louis, who takes up his fair share of film. Tonight, as she sits with the album on her lap, she turns the pages quickly, knowing what she's looking for and where to find it. There. Tucked between the travelogue shots from Kathy's African safari 5 years ago and several of Louis as a puppy is the picture she wanted to see. Strange and telling that after all those years of sharing a roof with her, there's only one photograph. In it, she's wearing her black housekeeper's uniform, as always, smiling at the camera. But it was a smile tempered with sadness, as always. Years went by, and Kathy never thought to ask the woman she knew as Anne Johnson anything beyond the cursory questions about her past. Of course, the information was never volunteered. She had her secrets, as everyone does, and she meant to carry them to the grave. She probably would have if she'd lived to a ripe old age. But dying young and slowly does something to a person. Diagnosed with a terminal illness, she felt the need to unburden herself. Kathy was the only one there to listen. The story was tragic, haunting, incredible. On her deathbed, when the time came, she asked Kathy to make her three promises. She's kept two. She's about to break the third. Carefully, with manicured fingernails, she slips the four corners of the photo from their holders. Then she picks up a fountain pen. Turning over the photograph, she slashes a line through the name written there years ago, before she knew. Anne Johnson. Beneath the crossed-out wrong name, She writes the right one. Brenda Neary.
Back home, Tess immediately heads for her room. Hang on there, her mother says. I need help dealing with these groceries. Tess scowls and starts unpacking a bag.
Thanks, Tess.
Thanks. Does she have a choice? About anything? It takes forever to unload the car and put stuff away. It's like Mom bought out the whole store, and there's not a lot of cupboard space here at the cottage.
I've got one more load of laundry to do. Want to watch a movie and help me fold, Tess?
Mom asks, putting the last can of Dr. Pepper into the fridge.
No, thanks, she says curtly, thinking of Heath at that lifeguard party without her.
Come on, you don't have to help fold if you don't want to. I'll make some popcorn, or we can have some of that Ben and Jerry's I just bought.
Tess softens, just a little. Ice cream does sound good.
I thought it was for Dad.
Not all of it.
Mom tries hard to cover a yawn.
What do you want to watch? You can pick.
Pick a long one. That's what Heath said when he was trying to get her to sneak out, supposedly to a movie with Beth, and meet him instead.
You won't even last through the opening credits, she tells her mother, frowning.
Her mother, yawning openly this time, can't exactly argue with that, but she says, I'll make it as long as I can, and if we don't get through the whole thing...
Forget it, Tess grumbles. What good is watching a movie if you can't see the ending?
Tess goes into her room without a backward glance and starts to slam the door. Thinking better of it, she closes it. Hard enough to let her mother know she doesn't want to be disturbed, but not hard enough to get herself grounded. Although, what's the difference? She might as well be grounded as it is. As she turns on the lamp and starts toward her dresser to find some pajamas, something catches her eye on the bed. Stepping closer, she sees that it's a little paper gift bag. With a sigh, Cam dials Debbie, hoping she's not 30,000 feet over the North Atlantic with her cell turned off. She isn't. But she is in the middle of something. Cam can tell by her distracted tone when she says, Hey, what's up?
Where are you?
A slight pause, then, Heathrow, I can barely keep track anymore. I actually had to check and see.
When are you coming home?
Hopefully late tomorrow, but there's weather in the afternoons at this time of year, so you never know. Why?
I was going to ask a favor, but that's okay, forget it.
Are you sure?
Positive.
Debbie doesn't push the issue, nor does she linger on the phone. She's not big on favors, doing them for other people, anyway. Which is why you shouldn't have bothered calling in the first place, Cam tells herself, hanging up. Even if Debbie was going to be here, she wouldn't exactly jump at the chance to chaperone 2 14-year-old girls at the movies so that Cam and Mike can have some time to talk about their marriage. Oh well. For all Cam knows, Mike is going to show up here tomorrow with divorce papers. And then what? And then it's over. That's what. You lose. Everybody loses, including Mike. But chances are he'll be long gone before he ever figures that out. The gift bag is bright green, with hot pink tissue paper sticking at the top. Mom must have left it here earlier before they went to the supermarket. Frowning, Tess wonders what the occasion might be. Maybe Mom is just feeling bad for being so strict all summer. She reaches into the bag and finds a note. You're invited is etched at the top of the card, which has a colorful green and pink plaid border that matches the bag. So it's not a note, but an invitation. Someone wrote it on a computer, using a fancy font. Please join me for a midnight swim. Skinny dipping optional, but you must wear this. No RSVP, just meet me at the pool. Side gate will be open. Heath.
Skinny dipping?
Tess swallows hard. Wear this? What does that mean? Wear what? And more importantly, how did Heath get this into her room? She glances over at the open window.
Could he possibly have crawled in through the screen? She crosses over to take a look. The screen is all the way down, latched at the bottom. But that doesn't mean Heath didn't pry it open, sneak in, sneak back out again, and close it. She tells herself that would be a totally romantic gesture, but for some reason, the thought of him coming into her room doesn't sit well with her. Then again, he's Heath, and she's crazy about him, and he wants her to meet him tonight at midnight for a swim, or skinny dip. Whoa. What now? Remembering the gift bag, Tess pokes through the tissue paper. Tucked into the bottom, she finds a small white gift box wrapped in a white bow. It fits into the palm of her hand, and something tells Tess as she unties the bow with a trembling hand that it's not a bathing suit. Yawning, Cam double-checks the deadbolt on the front door. Locked. Back door. Locked as well. Returning to the living room, she turns off the lamp, then the floor fan. It creak whirs into silence. Beyond the screens, she can hear crickets and a night breeze stirring the leaves. She steps closer to the window and peers out. Lights from neighboring houses beam reassuringly, yet Cam feels distinctly uneasy. She finds herself wishing this was tomorrow night, with Mike here. Oh, please. What kind of bullshit is that? That's what Debbie would say. You don't need a man around to keep you safe. No, she really doesn't. Cam's done a good job of that on her own for several months now. If tomorrow Mike tells her that their marriage is over, she'll survive. So will Tess. No matter what, she thinks fiercely, and turns away from the window. Her gaze falls on the laptop. She spent another hour perusing the missing child profiles and kept going back to Kimberly Osborne's. She still can't place her. Maybe it'll come to her later. On the coffee table is a plastic laundry basket filled with dryer hot clothes she just finished folding. It was the last load and smaller than the others, the reds. She can leave them to put away tomorrow. Or do it now, and have a good reason to check in on Tess. She picks up the basket and heads down the hall. Balancing the laundry on her hip with one hand, she knocks on Tess's door, hoping she isn't deafened by her iPod headphones. A grouchy voice comes from within. "What do you want?" Cam cracks the door open. "I've got some stuff to put in your drawers." Tess is lying on her bed, wearing a pair of summer pajamas. No iPod, no book or magazine. Clearly, she's moping. "Are you okay?" "Not really." "Anything I can do?"
"Let me have a life."
"You have a life."
"Not one worth living."
Teenaged melodrama. That's all it is. Yet Tess's words make Cam more uneasy than ever. She lifts a small pile of laundry off the top of the basket. "Here are some of your clothes," she tells Tess. "Do you want to put them away, or should I?"
"I will. Just leave them."
Cam deposits the stack of folded red garments on the dresser, then bends over and plants a kiss on her daughter's forehead. Then she gently touches the small scratch on her cheek. "Does that hurt?" she asks.
"No."
Cam pauses.
"You know, Tess, things will look a lot better in the morning."
"They always do."
"No, they don't. Not always."
Cam heads for the door, realizing nothing she says is going to make a difference. Just glad that they've gotten through another day unscathed, other than a minor scratch on Tess's cheek. "One day at a time," as Kathy says. "That's all it takes." Precisely at midnight, Tess arrives, breathless, at the Pickerings' oversized house on North Atlantic Avenue. She almost didn't make it. While lying on her bed, waiting for the minutes to tick by, she dozed off to sleep. When she awakened, it was 11:40. She stripped off her pajamas, under which she was wearing her bathing suit, and quickly pulled on the pair of shorts she'd worn earlier, and a t-shirt from the top of the pile her mother left to be put away.
After grabbing her sandals and her cell phone, she stuck her head into Mom's room to make sure she was sound asleep. Yep, and snoring. She never used to. Yet another side effect of those pregnancy hormones, Tess figures. She snuck silently out of the house, then practically ran all the way here, worrying the whole way about what's going to happen. Mom would kill me if she knew what I'm up to, but she won't know. I'll be back home in bed long before morning, she reminds herself with a twinge of guilt. But she wouldn't have to resort to sneaking around in the night if her mother would just give her a little bit of freedom. It's not like she's asking if she can go backpacking in Europe for a month. All she wanted was to go to the movies with Beth. No, it wasn't. That was a total lie. You just wanted to be alone with Heath. Yeah, but Mom didn't know that, and she still said no. Tess looks up at the house, which is 3 stories tall and set back from the street. Why, she wonders, is it so dark? Not just inside, but outside as well. You'd think Heath would have at least left the outdoor lights on. There's no moon tonight to help her along as she starts to pick her way along the side path, separated from the driveway by hedges. Uh-oh, she stops short, remembering. In her haste to get out of the house, she forgot to wear the shark's tooth necklace. Cam awakens with a start and looks at the clock. Midnight. Yawning, she swings her legs over the edge of the bed and stands. She shouldn't have drunk so much water before bed. Not that it seems to matter lately how much she drinks. Her bladder is feeling the full effects of the pregnancy these days. She's in and out of the bathroom quickly, wanting only to get back to bed, back to sleep. Passing Tess's closed door, she wonders if she's still sulking in there. Maybe she should talk to her. Cam hesitates, goes back to the door, and knocks softly. No reply. Maybe Tess is plugged into her headphones. Or maybe she's asleep by now, having sweet dreams. I should let her rest. In her own room, Cam climbs into bed, sinks back against the pillow, and waits for sleep to reclaim her. Up ahead, Tess can see the dimmest outline of the gate, propped open as Heath had promised. She can hear the pool pump somewhere beyond, humming along, intermittently drowned out by the crashing of the distant surf. Heath? She calls in a hushed voice, inching her way forward. He doesn't answer. But he's there. She can sense his presence, but she can't see him. The pool water is catching light from somewhere to cast eerie, moving shadows up to the surrounding boughs. Tess doesn't like this. Not one bit. Remembering the prank Heath pulled on her in the water today, pretending there was a shark, she wonders if he's going to jump out at her. Heath, she says louder, not caring that it's midnight. No one besides Heath can possibly hear her. His brother must be working at this hour, and the other houses are too far away. Heath, cut it out. I know you're there. Still no reply. Cam's heart is pounding as if she's just run a marathon, yet she hasn't moved a muscle. All that's racing is her brain as she lies here, eyes open in the dark, body tense. Another vision. It came out of nowhere. Tess. Not here, safe and sound, in her bed, wearing pajamas. She has on the brick-colored LBI t-shirt Cam had left on her dresser earlier, on top of the pile of laundry. In the background is some kind of stone wall. Cam has seen it before, in her vision about Leah Roby. A shadow looms on the wall behind Tess. Stay away from me, she whimpers. Don't come near me with that. With what? And who's there? Who is it? Tess recoils, turning her head. On her cheek is a small scratch. Familiar. Fresh. The scene dissolves even as Cam comprehends that it doesn't portend some far-off future event. The scratch, the shirt. It's going to happen soon. She shouldn't have come. She should turn around right now and... Tess screams,
Doing an abrupt about-face, she sees a shadowy figure looming in the path directly behind her. It pounces, presses something over her nose and mouth. Then everything goes black. Cam throws open Tess's door. The bed is empty, the coverlet rumpled. Don't panic. It doesn't mean... Something glints on the table beside the bed, and Cam steps closer. A shark's tooth on a silver chain. Chapter 18. The girl who lived until now under the guise of Tess Hastings lies in the back seat of the SUV, eyes closed. Out cold, she hasn't stirred since Beach Haven, an hour and a good 60 miles ago. Smothering her with an ether-soaked towel was much easier than trying to inject an anesthetic, like last time. No muss, no fuss. I'll have to remember that for the future. Wait a minute. There won't be a need for it in the future. It's over. It's not going to happen again. She's back where she belongs at last. With me. And she'll never run away again. The headlights arc into a long, tree-lined dirt lane. Here we are, sweetie pie. The car bounces over ruts in the road, ruts that help keep prying locals at bay. Oh, look, baby, are you awake? Do you see? The house has come into view. Bright strings of old-fashioned colored bulbs twinkle from the porch eaves and in the front window. The Christmas tree glows warmly. See how pretty? I've kept it all just like it was when you left. Home sweet home. At last. Conan O'Brien is interviewing some skinny girl who's famous for no apparent reason whatsoever, and Lucinda has no clue whatsoever why she's watching. Except that she can't sleep, and anything is better than tossing and turning in bed in the next room. Anything? I really think Paris Hilton is, like, underestimated, Conan's guest declares. No sooner has Lucinda aimed the remote and zapped her into oblivion than the silence is broken by the telephone. Phone calls after midnight never bode well. As she lifts the receiver, her mind runs the gamut of probable callers, possible scenarios, all except this. Lucinda, it's Randy. The breath is sucked right out of her at the sound of his voice, and she can't find her own. No matter, because he's doing all the talking. If there's any way you can possibly get out to the island, I need you here. Another kid has gone missing, and it looks like we've got a serial crime on our hands. Can you come? Lucinda looks at her packed luggage across the room, thinks about her trip tomorrow, the one that's supposed to carry her far, far away from Randy, give her a fresh perspective. I'm leaving for a trip in about 6 hours, she tells him. Then he says the one thing that could possibly make her own plans irrelevant. The kid who got snatched is Cam Hastings' daughter. Mike. I need Mike. He still doesn't know. During that first frenzied telephone conversation with Detective Barakat, after Cam realized Tess had disappeared from the house, he instructed her not to call Mike yet.
Why not?
She asked, distraught. I'll tell you when I get there. Just sit tight. Sit tight? When your only child has vanished in the night? Somehow, Cam managed not to run out of the house in hysterics. Mercifully, she doesn't remember much about the wait for the police to show up. She only knows they got here quickly. Now she and the detective are standing in the bedroom where just hours ago Tess was lying on the bed in her pajamas. A pair of crime scene investigators talk on radio transmitters, dust surfaces for fingerprints, take measurements and photographs. But it's nowhere near the fever-pitch frenzy Cam would have anticipated under the circumstances. That's because there's no hard evidence that Tess was kidnapped. Nothing other than Cam's gut feeling. Even the shark's tooth necklace means little to the investigation at this stage. Yes, Rebecca Pearson had one. But that could be circumstantial, as far as the authorities are concerned. No one but Cam, in a psychic vision, ever even saw the necklace on Leah Roby. The police, with the exception of Randall Barakat, who hasn't left Cam's side except to call Lucinda Sloan, think Tess simply ran away. That, or her father took her. Fallout from a messy marital separation. That's why they won't let Cam call Mike. They're trying to find him first. They tried his apartment, but he wasn't there. Randall Barakat didn't actually tell Cam that Mike is a suspect, but he didn't have to. It's obvious. Cam remembers Rebecca Pearson's father being questioned that day, taking it in stride, reassuring his wife, "The parents are always suspects." Cam can't take that in stride.
"Mike doesn't have anything to do with this," Cam keeps saying, and she's pretty sure Randall, though he alone, believes her.
As Lucinda speeds toward the exit for the island causeway, she'd give anything to make a U-turn and go right back home. Home, or to Alaska. Anywhere but here. She knows what she's going to find when she reaches Cam Hastings. She's visited the same scene over and over again. The house filled with cops. The child's empty bedroom. The traumatized mother. Only this time, Lucinda might not be able to maintain that famous Sloan detachment. This time, it's personal. This time, she knows the mother all too well. This time, unlike ever before, she saw the event before it actually happened. She shudders, remembering the vision, the premonition, actually, of a fierce, futile struggle between Cam's daughter and a hooded figure. The vision has